This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The past 9 months have demonstrated many weaknesses of American democracy, one of which is the nation's continued denial of racial injustice. Under Donald Trump's administration, the modest gains of the past decade are being rolled back, and movements like Black Lives Matter have been declared by Trump's base to be dangerous or irrelevant. But a closer examination reveals that BLM has in fact continued its activism, morphed into different forms, strengthened local chapters or blossomed new ones, and even entered into the realm of local electoral politics. Danny McLean is a contributing writer to The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute, and her cover story, The Future of Black Lives Matter, appears in the cover of the often the cover of the October 9th, 2017 edition of The Nation. Welcome to the program, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
So first, how do you characterize the way in which Black Lives Matter is being viewed in our national consciousness this year? It burst into the scene during the Ferguson protests. It was really born in the aftermath of Trayvon Martin's killing. But the year before the election took place, mainstream media finally seemed to be paying attention, and it was part of a national dialogue. What is it this year?
I think it's been pushed into the sidelines of any kind of national dialogue. I think that one place where we really began to see a shift was in July of last year with the shootings of officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge. This was last summer in July. We began to see conservative commentators laying blame for those police shootings at the feet of BLM. Calling Black Lives Matter a hate group, and really attempting to create a narrative that Black Lives Matter was not responding to, you know, systemic injustices within the criminal justice system, but was instead, you know, inciting violence against officers. And I think that that kind of characterization of BLM is carried over into this year and then strengthened by the kind of rhetoric that Trump and the Trump administration has brought into the mainstream.
And then we saw the marches in Charlottesville, Virginia, of a number of so-called alt-right groups coming together and very clearly saying that they now feel so bold about their racism that they're willing to just wear it on their sleeve and come together. You start out your article in The Nation with an effort to start a chapter of Black Lives Matter in Charlottesville. Tell us a little bit about that, and why though these sorts of continued resurgences of racism in the U.S. Keep spurring Black Lives Matter to keep blossoming.
I talked to two organizers in Charlottesville, Jelaine Schmidt, who's a professor at UVA, and David Von Strawn, who's a native of Charlottesville. And, what they said was that as they had been following the public debates around the Confederate monuments, they felt that there wasn't a voice of Black Charlottesville that represented their interests. So what you had was Black pastors, you had the local NAACP chapter, but both of those groups seemed to be very conservative, very worried, very quiet, and they weren't coming out with the kind of strength against, you know, participating in these conversations about the monuments that these two activists wanted to see. And so they felt that there was a real gap in racial justice organizing. And when they looked around at different possibilities of a type of group that they would want to start, they felt that BLM was that group. Jelaine Schmidt, who is the UVA professor, said that, she felt that she identifies as a queer Black woman, and the fact that BLM was founded by three Black women, two of whom identify as queer, that really spoke to her. She also said that she felt that there was a kind of unapologetic Blackness about BLM and how it showed up all over the country, and she wanted to bring that kind of energy there to Charlottesville as well.
So one of the other ways in which Black Lives Matter is evolving this year is its entry into local electoral politics. And of course, it's different in different parts of the country. And sometimes when we think about social movements on the left pouring their energy into electoral politics, we fear that it can subsume the energy. It can take over the movement and it can be a dead end for movements. But when you do it on a hyper-local level, of course, it can make a big difference. What are some of the ways in which Black Lives Matter has gotten involved in very local electoral races?
There is, I think in terms of who's already doing the work, one of the chapters that really stood out to me was BLM Lansing. They've started a project called Election.
This is in Michigan, yeah.
That's right, in Michigan. They've started, they're coordinating a statewide coalition to try to do voter education. They're starting on the local level and, you know, trying to affect local races, trying to educate people around, you know, what particular offices are, hold forums so that people can hear directly from candidates and be asked questions, the questions that directly speak to the concerns and the interests of BLM members and other social justice groups there in Lansing. So that's one place where I saw this kind of organizing happening. There's a long section in the story about activity happening in St. Louis, led by a group called the St. Louis Action Council. I spoke to a young organizer there named Kayla Reed, who talked about the work that St. Louis Action Council has done. They started with getting involved in the city attorney, circuit attorney race there, and helped to usher in the city's first Black circuit attorney. And really, like they said, it was very similar to what I just described in Lansing. Okay, let's really educate ourselves about the power that these offices hold. Let's really look at the candidates. Let's ask them questions about cash bail and about their thoughts on marijuana decriminalization and all these things that we care about and we're concerned about. They then they succeeded in getting this particular their candidate into office. They then began to pour a lot of their energy into Tashara Jones, who was the city treasurer, her race for mayor that happened earlier this year. And they were able to sense a lot of support and energy for this candidate in Black communities, this same candidate who was being very underestimated by kind of the mainstream media and by other elected officials. And so that's the kind of work that I am seeing and that I heard about when I talked to sources, that people are starting on these very local levels. They're educating themselves, they're educating their neighbors, and they're really throwing the weight of their organizing power behind candidates to do things like canvassing and get out the vote.
And it should be mentioned that it was, of course, in St. Louis that we saw the latest flashpoint over a police killing, actually a police killing that happened a number of years ago, but the acquittal of the killer happening just a few weeks ago, prompting people taking to the streets of St. Louis. And Tashara Jones sadly lost in a fairly crowded field of mayoral candidates to the only white candidate. But I'm assuming that BLM chapter there is undeterred. There's also the recent election of Chokwe Antar Lumumba of Jackson, Mississippi. Tell us a little bit about that race and whether BLM played a role there. And this was a successful race.
I think what's important to know is that, we call this current iteration of Black racial justice organizing BLM, broadly speaking. But really, there are kind of these different groups all over the country that don't necessarily go under the moniker BLM, but some of them are new. Many of them are new formations. Many of them have been around for quite a long time. So the St. Louis group, that's St. Louis Action, that grew up in the wake of the Ferguson uprising. The work that's been happening in Jackson, Mississippi, you know, my understanding is that it's been happening there a long time, you know, for quite some time. It predates kind of this current era of BLM organizing. I talked to Alicia Garza, who is one of the founders of the BLM hashtag and one of the founders of the BLM Global Network. She talked about, excitement around Stacey Abrams' campaign, a Black woman who's running for the position of governor of Georgia. She talked about a number of Black candidates around the country who, like a Tashara Jones, are saying the types of things that BLM organizers want to hear. And she talked about the importance of national organizations mobilizing and deploying resources to these local groups to support and prop up these local candidates wherever it's needed.
And I think that's a really important point. Black Lives Matter by itself isn't actually an organization. It's the umbrella name that we give to a movement that has emerged since Ferguson, during Ferguson and since then. But there is, of course, the movement for Black Lives, which I understand is sort of seen as the ostensible official home of a platform that people who feel a sense of feel aligned with the spirit of Black Lives Matter adopt. And you talk a little bit about that platform, which is an incredibly broad-based and very radical platform. Are you seeing that? And that was put out a while ago, but are you seeing that platform as a guiding set of ideals that local Black Lives Matter chapters and groups sort of affiliated with the movement might be trying to actualize?
Absolutely. So when I was talking about the work in St. Louis and the kind of, hosting of candidates forums and that type of thing, Kayla Reed, the organizer who I mentioned, she talked explicitly about, the questions that we used for, these forums. We drew, we were asking them questions to see how their ideas measured up against the vision for Black Lives. She said one of the things that was incredibly, I heard this from several people actually, one of the things that was really exciting about Tashara Jones was that she was rejecting these calls to increase a police hiring in the police department. She was saying, we don't need more officers. What we need is to place social workers in the field alongside police officers. And what Kayla said to me was that told us that she understands that she was making a proposal in a divest invest framework. In other words, divesting from institutions that harm and marginalize Black people and instead investing in policies and practices that support the health and well-being of Black people. And she said, this is exactly, there, if you look at the vision for Black Lives, the policy platform, you see that kind of divest, invest language being used. Also, when I talked to organizers in Charlottesville, I think it was David Von Strahn who said, look, at meetings, we bring out the vision for Black Lives, we bring out the BLM principles, and as we have conversations, we're referring back to these documents and making sure that decisions that we make and that the conversations that we have are rooted in these kind of foundational documents. So yes, everywhere, when I have these conversations, I think people take these documents, and particularly the vision for Black Lives, which came out in August of last year, very seriously.
Now, are you seeing a sort of creative approaches by local chapters of Black Lives Matter or groups that are working for racial justice, use models that are unique to their circumstances, unique to the size of their city, unique to the history or context of that city, and learning also from one another, doing that sort of organizing across state and city boundaries?
Yes. I mean, I think, one example that came up, this came up in my conversation with Charlene Carruthers, who is a leader within the Black Youth Project, which is it's a national organization, but Charlene is based in Chicago. And I often think of their most visible work happening in Chicago. She talked about, in July of last year, and I mentioned that I see that as a kind of turning point in the movement. Many organizers I spoke to agreed that that was a turning point because of this kind of new focus coming from conservative commentators laying blame for the police shootings at the feet of BLM. She said that after that happened, there were a number of organizations, BYP 100, We Can't Breathe Coalition, I believe, there were several that all over the country decided that they were going to get involved in direct actions. They were going to either do a lockdown at the police union headquarters in Lower Manhattan. They were going to show up at Holman Square, which is a location where the Chicago police were holding people without appropriate legal representation. They were showing up at what they saw as these sites of police misconduct, police abuse of power, and they were putting their bodies on the line at these locations to try to make a statement. And what Charlene said was that, we made this decision to do this across organizations in different cities around the country because we wanted to point out that, our analysis is about structural problems, is about the the problems kind of at the heart of policing in this country, we're not focused on, and nor do we wish any harm to individual police officers. So I think that was, you know, one example of where you see the kind of an example of what they call the lead. This is a, many people say this is a leaderful movement, that it's kind of full of leaders. There isn't one charismatic leader at the head, but you have people in different cities who are empowered to make decisions about what is going to make sense for them in that location, but also collaborating and coordinating with other groups nationwide.
Yeah, a lot of the sort of Occupy Wall Street language involved leaderless movement, and I think BLM has turned that around to say they're a leaderful movement. I want to go back to where we started, which is how Black Lives Matter and the fight for racial justice in general during the era of Trump, the stakes are higher now than ever before, because the overt white supremacists, the ones who would basically like everybody to shut up or even disappear, have an ally in the White House. With the protests by people like Colin Kaepernick and some of his allies in the NFL, people are wondering, can Black Americans protest in any form that is acceptable to some faction of white Americans? It seems as though any kind of protest, no matter how peaceful, going from all the way to the most peaceful and quiet type of protest to the most disruptive, is dismissed as being, you know, the work of dangerous people, quote, thugs, and those kinds of racialized epithets come in. And so some are asking, well, are we even allowed to protest? Are people of color, are Black Americans in particular, even allowed to protest in a country where people constantly remind us of the importance of free speech?
Right. Well, what I learned from my sources is that, yes, you know, people were very reluctant to, some people really rejected this in the age of Trump frame, because some people said, look, this is just a kind of heightening of what we've always had to deal with. And so, one thing that people really stressed, and Chanel Matthews, who's a BLM Global Network spokesperson, she probably put this most plainly. She said, you know, yeah, there are new tactics. You're going to see new tactics develop. Of course, you know, people are moving into electoral politics, but we're going to use whatever tactics, you know, the people who we see as our constituents, or the people on whose behalf we're working, whatever is going to help them get free. And so she said, you know, people are still protesting. You still see people in the streets. Charlottesville is an example of that. Boston is an example of that, when white supremacists tried to mobilize there this summer as well. I think that there's a real acknowledgement that things have shifted. Under the Trump administration, you see in the article, I talk about the proliferation of these so-called Blue Lives Matter bills. This is actually in state legislatures, not at the federal level, but where you see, you know, police officers almost being, you know, created as a protected class, and saying that defining, you know, certain acts against them as hate crimes, and increasing penalties for anyone who, you know, spits on an officer or something like that. We see, you know, Jeff Sessions in the Justice Department, you know, ending this ban on the transfer of military weapons to local police departments. This is something that that Obama had put in place, saying, you know, there's no reason a local police department needs like a grenade launcher or a bayonet, and Sessions is reversing that. So I think that there is some truth to this, like in the age of Trump frame, things are changing. And I think what I learned from the people that I talked to is that they're going to continue with direct action and with this idea of putting their bodies on the line and protest. And they're also getting creative and thinking about what else they can do as well. Alicia Garza probably put it most plainly when she said something like, if we don't, we have to come up with new tactics, or else we're going to see our ability to operate above ground really diminish and go away. So I think they're aware that there's so much pressure on them that they could be driven underground. People are, you know, worried about being, you know, all we've seen throughout history how Black activists have been driven underground, you know, exiled, put in prison. And I think there's a real not awareness that BLM organizers need to get creative about how they do their work so they can avoid those consequences.
Well, Danny, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from our site. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
My guest is Danny McLean, contributing writer to The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. We've been discussing her cover story in the newest edition of The Nation magazine called The Future of Black Lives Matter. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.